Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, and this is Eat Your Words. My name is Kathy Arway. I'm your host, and I'm really excited. Today, I'm holding a book called Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook, and it's a topic that's very dear to my heart. I wanted to read a little bit from the preface to the book, and then we'll speak with this author very shortly. So why bother is the answer too many single people give me when I ask what they cook for themselves for dinner. Their next remark is usually along the lines of, why go through all the trouble if it's just for me? Sadly, they think that the only time it's worth firing up the stove is when their cooking has an audience. I understand the impulse, but I have to say, there's really no such thing as just you. Who is more important than you? So that is written by Joe Yonan. How are you? He's on the line, I hope.
I'm good, Kathy. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Good. Thanks so much. This is an exciting book. And, you know, you've been a longtime journalist for the Washington Post.
Yep.
You know, award-winning newspaper column there.
And
you've also been. Yeah, congrats. And you've also written another book on cooking for one, which is called, is very highly celebrated. It's called Serve Yourself, Nightly Adventures in Cooking for One.
That came out.
Yeah. So, and, you know, this is the new one, so it's really exciting. But I'm curious, how did you come into the topic of cooking for one? Was this an intentional thing, or did it just sort of evolve or happen?
Well, the way that the Cooking for One interest came about was because I was cooking, and I looked around, and I was the only one there.
And I
was hungry. So seriously, I've certainly been cooking for myself for many, 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 many years, mm-hmm. and have been single in many of those periods. Mm-hmm. And in 2008, my deputy editor of the Post, Bonnie Demick, and I were looking for some columns, some regular things that we wanted to have in the section.
Okay.
And we realized that we were getting relatively frequent questions from people about how to handle different cooking obstacles when you're a single cook, and started looking around a little bit and doing some research, and realized that it was the fastest growing household size in the country. And so we started the column, and initially it was to have different voices every month. Judith Jones wrote the first one, and this was before she wrote a book on the same topic.
Mm-hmm.
She wrote a column for us, and it was sort of about, you know, setting a place setting for herself after her husband died, kind of realizing that cooking could be meditative and that she would respect herself by setting a nice place setting and lighting a candle and having her nice linens and everything. And then I wrote the second one talking about how, you know, I liked to make tacos and eat them while I watched TV. So to try to get at the different mindsets of people.
Different moods.
After about 6 months, I kind of commandeered the thing because I realized I had a lot I wanted to say on the topic. And so I took it over myself and wrote it for a few years.
Yeah, and tons of recipes there. And that is interesting, you know, that it's a growing, household number of people. But I think that it's also really helpful to have, even if you're not cooking for one, but if you're just, together, or, you know, you just have a busy different schedules. Everyone has crazy different schedules these days. So,
as I said in the first book, I quoted Cher, I paraphrased Cher by saying, sooner or later, we all eat alone.
That's great.
Whether you're single or not, yeah.
And, you know, the book is really helpful because I noticed in the back there's a lot of, like, really basics, like how to make a great pot of beans. Mm-hmm. That's something I wish I had, like, when I started cooking really frequently about 10 or so years ago. And, you know, how to make rice. I hear so many people ask me that question. So this has a whole gamut of really practical advice.
Thanks.
Yeah.
And yeah, I feel like people, you know, they think that cooking is really hard. And I think that certainly it can be hard,
mm-hmm.
You know, depending on your ambitions and what you're doing. But it doesn't have to be that hard.
Right.
And it doesn't have to take that much time. And it's actually okay if it takes a little bit of time.
Right.
Because it's worth it, you know?
It's
a kind of an important thing, and I think we prioritize in the wrong ways.
Yeah, and I think it's fun because you have all these, like, different pieces now that you know how to make. Like, you have this marinated and baked tofu, you have some rice, you know how to make beans, and people can really free up their creativity and just make something a little bit, you know, new and improvise,
yeah.
If you will.
Yeah, I mean, my idea with those was sort of to turn the idea of leftovers on its head, and rather than saying that, you know, you should make a big pot of, you know, black bean chili or something, and you should, you know, freeze it or refrigerate it and eat off of it for weeks on end,
mm-hmm.
the same thing over and over, the same finished dish. I like to try to encourage people to make these building blocks, you know, on the weekends when they have time, and then use those to make quicker weeknight kind of
off-the-cuff
dishes.
Yeah, you have the confidence now. And that's what I love to do myself. So it's great to see those real basics covered throughout. And the other thing about this book, it's all vegetarian recipes. And,
that's right, yeah.
You know, that, is it more practical, you think, for single cooks to cook vegetarian food, or actually more challenging? Or how did that happen?
Well, I think it sort of depends on how you look at it. I mean, in some ways, it's keeping a vegetarian kitchen in some ways is a lot easier because
mm-hmm.
you don't have to worry quite as much about things like cross-contamination of,
mm-hmm.
of poultry and meats. And, you know, you can marinate some tofu and take it out onto the grill, and you can take it off the grill and put it right back in that marinade, you know,
right.
in a way that you can't do if you're, you know, if you're cooking chicken. So there's some things about it that are definitely easier. But I also think that cooking vegetables generally can seem a little bit more intimidating and mysterious to people than cooking meat. You know, it's not always
yeah.
quite as obvious what to do with some things in the same way that it is with meat. You know,
right.
And I think vegetables sometimes require a little bit more finesse.
Right, right.
But I think yeah. that one of the great things about cooking for yourself is that, you know, you can, if you decide that there are certain things that you do or don't want to eat, and not just vegetarianism, but, you know, if you want to eat local, or if you want to eat
mm-hmm.
all organic, or if you, you know, are gluten-free, or if you're trying to avoid, you know, certain kinds of foods,
mm-hmm.
you know, the best way to do that is, of course, to do it yourself.
Right. And actually, right now is, like, pretty much the best time to be a vegetarian. We're at the height of summer harvest season. You mentioned, you know, that here are some tricks that you can do when you go crazy at the farmer's market and you have so many things. I know a lot of people newly joined CSAs each year.
Right.
And have you, by any chance?
I have. I'm not a CSA member this year.
Right.
But I have been in the past. You know, it's a little bit hard sometimes when you're developing recipes,
mm-hmm.
certainly for the cookbook, and then even sometimes for the post. It can be a little difficult, I think, to be a CSA member because,
mm-hmm.
you know, you don't have quite as much control over what you're getting. That's also one of the beauties of a CSA, though,
yeah.
is that it forces you into this, you know, a creativity and a flexibility and
an iron chef game. Yeah.
Yeah. It promotes an intuitive approach to cooking, which I think is really important.
Yeah. So I think that this this book is a good way to preserve some of that harvest. What are some of your tips to, you know, for single cooks? One of the biggest problems I have is fresh herbs, and I tend to grow them on my windowsill just so I can snip and go. But if you don't have good light or something, what do you do when you get a bunch of herbs and you only need a few sprigs?
Right. No, it's really a tough thing for single cooks.
Gross.
And actually a lot of people, because in the markets, or in the supermarket particularly, they sell them in giant bunches or in those clamshell packs.
And they're expensive,
And most recipes you're not using very much. So, first I tell people if they have any ability to grow anything, any space, they should grow herbs because, you know, it's, as you said, it's so much easier to just pick what you want. But if you don't, I like to look at herbs somewhat like fresh flowers, so especially the sturdier ones like basil, mint, and parsley. So you strip off the bottom leaves so they're not going to be immersed in the water, and you cut the stems on the diagonal, so there's more surface area exposed, and you put them in a glass of fresh water on your countertop right where you can see them, and every day or two you change the water and cut the stems. Now, this is something that I've done with fresh flowers for many years, and you can, you know, extend flowers that way, and it's the same thing works with herbs.
Yeah, I think that's really intuitive.
Yeah, and then the more delicate ones, I like to, you know, like cilantro.
Okay, got it.
I like to wrap them in a damp paper towel and put them in a plastic bag. We have so many of those newspaper delivery bags. If you're a newspaper subscriber, you have those plastic delivery bags, and they actually are kind of this perfect size for something that you've rolled up in a paper towel, and they slide right in that sleeve, and that works pretty well. You just want to make sure that it's open, or you poke some holes in it, or it's at least open on the end. You don't want to tie it off because you want them to be able to breathe.
All right, so we're going for something snug and something that allows air in.
Yeah.
Very cool. Okay, good to know. And I'm sure you have plenty of newspaper bags in your household.
I certainly, certainly do.
That's nice. I love how you have sections here. And it really shows off the diversity of cooking for vegetarian entrees and so forth. But I noticed that you have a lot of interesting ethnic combinations in your dishes. Like there's a chicken fried cauliflower with miso onion gravy, and then also a sweet potato kimchi and greens hash. So how did some of these obviously, you know, fun, non-traditional recipes get born?
Well, in some ways, I think with so many recipe writers and cooks, you know, combinations happen based on what I have around, you know, or what I'm coming home, you know, from the market with, or what's staring me in the face. So I happen to be a longtime kimchi obsessive from way back. And, you know, kimchi is one of those things that just hits all of my sweet spots. I love spicy food. I love sour flavors, and I love fermented food. So it's got, you know, it's got all of those things. I liked sauerkraut long before I first tasted kimchi, and I like Tex-Mex flavors and Mexican food growing up in Texas, and salsas and everything. So in some ways, you know, kimchi is like sauerkraut meets salsa. So that was sort of a natural for that to enter into my pantry. I'm pretty obsessed with it. So I always have some around. I make it myself pretty regularly, and then there's lots of great people who make it, and I'm always trying different people's kimchi. So that makes its way into things based on, its presence. And then I start imagining what it might go with. And I, you know, some of my recipes are simply born from my own cravings. So like the grilled kimchi sandwich,
I was looking
for something really quick, you know, and I had some nice sharp cheddar, and I had, Asian pear, and I've made a kimchi that includes Asian pear in the kimchi.
Really?
It's cabbage and Asian pear. And I had some plainer kimchi. And I just thought, well, wouldn't that be good together? I tried it and liked it. I think it was when I had a spicy pimento cheese many years ago somewhere in the South that the idea first hit me that kimchi and cheese might be good together.
Yeah.
And I'm a word person too, so the very first thing I thought was kimchi and cheese, well, that would be kim cheese, wouldn't it? So that just made me laugh. And then if something makes me laugh, I tend to want to try it. So, but I've traveled a lot in, not extensively in Asia,
You've
but
been
I've
a
traveled
travel writer.
To Japan and have traveled in Europe. And everywhere I go, I pick up a lot of the flavors, and they seem to end up back in my in my kitchen somehow.
Right, because there's so many fun like pantry staples to stock up on.
That's right.
To flavor veggies with.
Smoked paprika is
nice.
You know, the first time I went to Spain many years ago, I came back with all of this pimentón, the smoked paprika, and started throwing that on everything, and that shows up in some of the recipes in this book too.
Fun. So you have a section, sort of like a interlude, called "Should We Stop Mocking Mock Meat?"
That's right.
And,
yeah.
Has your opinion on these ingredients, and I guess would that be more like tempeh, seitan, traditional
mock
meat?
Yeah, some of the packaged ones, like the the
monk
crumbles and
okay.
The by companies like Morningstar Farms and Gardein and. So it's some of them are a little less traditional. The seitan and the tempeh, in some ways,
okay.
I don't always consider, particularly tempeh and tofu, I don't really consider them to be...
They're their own thing, yeah.
They're their own thing,
okay.
Yeah.
All right, so we're talking about these more like newfangled crumbles and stuff like that. Has your opinion changed on them over time? Or?
Yeah, I think, like some people, I really thought that all mock meat was newfangled, and it wasn't until I started really paying attention and looking into it that I realized that, the tradition goes way, way, way back. Seitan, which is the basis of some of the most recent products, is a, it's a kneaded and rinsed wheat, and it started back in the 7th century of China, Buddhist monks and nuns were looking for something to use as a meat substitute, and they realized that when they, I'm not sure exactly how they
figured it out,
but somebody left it in the sink too long or something, but they realized that they had this high protein kind of malleable product that they could use. But I think I dismissed a lot of mock meats at restaurants, where the menus are full of quotation marks,
right.
Like quote unquote chicken. because I sort of have always thought, well, if you're vegetarian, don't you just want to eat vegetables rather than something highly processed? And I still feel that way to an extent, although there have been some recent products that I've liked more because they have fewer ingredients. And they actually, I feel like they are a little bit more adaptable in the kitchen, and I like them a little bit better. I don't really like the ones that are based on soy as much, and the texturized vegetable protein, TVP, those I'm not so crazy about. But there's some companies like Field Roast is a Seattle company that makes a wheat-based imitation meats that I like, and there's a company called Upton's Naturals out of Chicago that does the same. At the same time, though, I buy them very, very infrequently.
Yeah. These are new to me. Interesting. I'm
fascinated by them, like by the psychology behind them. I had that question about why, if you're vegetarian, why? But of course, the more I talk to people, too, I realize that for a lot of people, it's about baby steps, and they're interested in eating less meat. And the only way that they can kind of figure out how to do that is to
put this
eat
in your
something
chili.
That reminds them of meat.
And it's good to know. It's good to like have that bridge. It's sort of as you said, the baby steps.
Right.
I noticed that you don't shy away from tofu, though. Speaking of soy products.
No, I love tofu. I've eaten tofu certainly for decades, but it wasn't until I went to Japan that I realized kind of what tofu could actually be. And when it's freshly made, certainly, it can be many different textures. There's a custardy style of tofu that's so really good. Amazing.
Yeah.
That you can get when you're in Japan, or you can certainly make yourself and get at some Japanese restaurants here. But no, I like it. I like the texture of it when it's baked, when some of that watery mm-hmm. quality yeah. comes out of it,
right?
And when it's marinated, and like putting it in some dishes. I mean, it's not exactly something that I eat, you know, several times a week or anything, but I do really like it.
It's exciting because you know, when I've heard so many like haters, I guess, of tofu, uh-huh. and it seems like there's a lot of hang-ups over it, but it's just always exciting to see them in different combinations, different juxtapositions, different treatments.
I spent a lovely day in California a couple of years, or actually it was last year, with Andrea Nguyen, who's uh-huh. the
Asian
author
tofu
of
author.
Asian Tofu and yep. many other things, and we made you know, we made a couple different kinds of tofu together, and she cooked with it in a couple of ways, and it was just...
It's endless, right?
Oh, it's just so much fun. Yeah. I have a recipe from her in the book for these tofu egg wraps. They're kind of like little pancakes that you make with eggs and
yeah.
a little cornstarch, and
that
then you... And tofu that you've cut up kind of into chiclet-sized pieces, mm-hmm. and then you... use them to wrap like bean sprouts and greens and herbs, and there's a peanut sauce you dip it into, and that's really fantastic. And that was something I would never, ever, ever, ever would have
right.
come to on my own.
Yeah, that's an inventive one, and it looks really, really good, the
yeah.
Indonesian tofu and egg wraps. I just realized it's about time for a short little musical interlude, but we'll be right back chatting more with Joe Yonan.
This one's called Got the Feelin' by the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org. Stay tuned for more from Eat Your Words.
Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com. You got to stay thankful and thoughtful,
and you know you might. All right, we're back on Eat Your Words, chatting with Joe Yonan, author of Eat Your Vegetables. So I'm really curious to hear your thoughts. Have you seen this article that came out earlier this month in New York Times about the first taste test of a lab-produced burger?
Yeah.
Pretty interesting, pretty funky, like, you know, like science fiction almost stuff.
Yeah.
So, you know, stem cell produced meat, meat cell produced, I don't know what, lab produced. I can't figure out the science of it, but it is basically meat made from cow cells.
That's right. Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that? Cool? Exciting? Good? Bad? Freaky?
Complicated. Very complicated. I mean, I think that, you know, there's certainly a line of reasoning that says that to be able to produce something like meat that has the protein of meat, you know, mm-hmm. without
having to kill,
needing to raise the animal and kill the animal, is worth looking into because of certainly the environmental effects of raising animals and
yeah.
The impact there, and certainly the possibility that maybe you could feed more people more cheaply.
Right.
I have to say that I don't generally, I'm not really comfortable with the idea of the answer to this question being something that we create wholly man-made in a lab when there are such good uses of, good sources of protein in the right. plant kingdom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that sort of bothers me. And I also have to say, on a visceral level, you know, one of the reasons that I stopped eating meat for health reasons and out of a sense of environmental concern, certainly. But, you know, I'm not one of those people who finds meat to be stomach-turning, but still I found myself losing my cravings for it and being more and more drawn toward wanting vegetables.
Yeah.
And so I can't say that, like, when I think about a burger that was created in a lab, I don't want that.
Yeah.
Like on
I
a certain
you.
Fundamental level, right?
Right?
Does it make you hungry? Does it
no.
make your mouth water?
I mean,
it doesn't mine.
No, but I feel like it's impressive on a technical level. Like, that's pretty cool that happened. But yeah, it doesn't appetize. How could it? I don't know what that cow was fed. You know, I feel like that's a big... a part of it, and I don't know. Right, it's very
and I
strange.
Just wonder. You know, it's just hard to imagine what the other impacts of something
yeah.
like this might be. Mm. You know, not only on your body, in terms of you know what's in it, but
mm-hmm.
what's not in it. You know, one of the things that they had a hard time with the taste is that they didn't really. It was the muscle fiber they were able to grow, but they really weren't able to grow the fat. Right, so they had to. They had to, like, toss more, they had to add more fat to it.
I heard that, yeah, I heard that,
so
too,
what's
they weren't
the effect
able to.
Of, and I know they're working on this, but
right.
but what's the effect of eating straight muscle fiber that doesn't have any fat in it?
Know.
What does our body want and need, and how is it going to respond to something that's missing certain aspects? And what kinds of things might it be missing that we don't even understand
right.
or know? So those are questions that I certainly would have about it, too.
And very few people have tasted this, but I would think that most of the veggie dishes in this book taste better. Just, you know,
yeah,
just
I would
hunch.
Think so. Yeah, people said that it tasted almost like a regular burger. Nobody spat it out. Nobody cringed.
Oh.
But they talked about how it wasn't as juicy and that it was a little kind of crunchy on the outside,
uh-huh.
but that it wasn't disgusting. Somebody described it as a, quote, an animal protein cake.
Okay.
Which doesn't really
that
sound
doesn't
very
sound
good either.
Great.
Yum.
So since becoming a vegetarian, how many years, by the way, have you been a vegetarian?
Just a year.
Cool.
You know, and I'm still here and there, very occasionally, I'm still tasting
mm-hmm.
things just to keep up on stuff for my job. You know, if I'm at a restaurant with a bunch of friends, I'm not ordering meat, but if somebody orders something and they, you know, it's some unique combination and they say, you've got to really try this, I'm certainly taking, you know, a small bite of something
right.
here and there. And not cooking it at home at all.
Mm-hmm. But you're not missing it in your tacos when you make it at home in front of the TV.
No.
That's cool.
No, I've got plenty of stuff to put in those tacos.
Nice. what are some of the biggest benefits you think you've felt in the last year since... Is it you're
yeah.
spending less, maybe, or like?
What's, I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Maybe you're spending less, or you losing weight, or is...
My energy,
mm-hmm.
I would say, is the biggest thing.
Okay.
It's certainly been easier for me to, to take a little weight off and to keep weight off when I'm trying.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the biggest thing for me has been my energy, and I don't have food comas anymore. You know, those feelings
meat
that you have
over.
When you go out for a really indulgent restaurant meal, particularly.
Yeah, that's good.
So that's been good. I had some recent blood work for the first time, and there's definitely been some improvement in my blood work. You know, I didn't stop eating meat out of, you know, nothing happened. I didn't have a heart attack or anything, or my
mm-hmm.
doctor didn't tell me that I needed to stop eating meat. But I have had high cholesterol. My family, it runs in my family.
Oh.
And the cholesterol improved a little bit, you know, it wasn't like super dramatic.
Yeah.
But that's also because I eat, you know, I've eaten relatively healthfully for a very long time.
Okay.
But like my blood sugar improved, wow, and my triglycerides improved, blah, blah, blah. But mostly it's been that, you know, I just feel good.
Yeah, that's encouraging.
Yeah.
So we're about out of time, but I just had one last question for you. An example of a dish, maybe, or a type of dish or technique that we should most certainly not be cooking for one. Because I've made a lot of mistakes in my time, and I'd love to help spare other people who are just getting into
things that, that you shouldn't try to cook for one. Like, well, I would say, you know, most casseroles probably. I wouldn't make a big.
Okay.
I wouldn't make a big casserole for one. You know, and I would say I wouldn't. I mean, I know people like, you know, making big batches of things, but I would say, and holding on to them and freezing them, but I would say I wouldn't, you know, make like a giant pot of soup and then freeze it and then feel like you're sort of tied to it forever.
Yeah. Those are time-consuming things to make, too.
Yeah. What's that?
Those are time-consuming things to make, too.
Yes. In my previous book, I have some soup-based recipes that I really like, where what you do is you make sort of a concentrate, and you freeze that, and then you use that to be the beginnings of a soup that you would make on the fly.
Clever.
So that's I think that's a much better way to go, so you're not, you know, you're not tied to this one dish. I mean, I think big cakes and stuff like that are not smart probably to make for one unless you are going to take them to your office and share them with your colleagues, unless you want to eat the entire thing, which you might want to. So that's also a risk.
Well, excellent tip. And this book is so full of them. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Sure. It was really fun, Kathy. I really appreciate it.
And have a great summer. And thanks, everyone here at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.